Okay. We're kind of getting close to the end of 2 Corinthians. Everybody have a bulletin on the back there as outline for the verses and such. So we are in 2 Corinthians. Well, we'll do a quick review in chapter 10 here. Let me just read a couple of verses from last week. It's 2 Corinthians 10, verses 4 and 5 as review. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. And we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. You know, just studying that last week just, to me, was full of hope. That there is nothing that you struggle with. There's no temptation. There's no thing that gets a hold of you. And things get a hold of all of us, don't they? It could just be a pattern of thinking. That, to me, that could be one of the most difficult things to break. Just a pattern of thinking. We just respond in this way that we've always responded in. We just have this groove. Or it could be a specific sin. Lust or anger, envy, any of those things. And we just feel like there's no hope because we keep falling to the same thing over and over and over. Or we see what goes on in other people's lives and we have empathy and compassion that this person's struggling with this thing that they just never can seem to get above. But that's not the case. It's not that they can never get above it. That we have weapons of righteousness to demolish strongholds. Those areas of our life and other people's lives to have a hold of us. There's nothing else that can break those strongholds because it's a spiritual battle. It's not a psychological battle. It's not a physical battle. It's not an emotional battle. All those things may be tied in. But it's a spiritual battle that can only be won on spiritual grounds, such as through prayer, like Susie was mentioning this morning, through extreme faith, through the Word. That God empowers those things, and that's the way He chooses to demolish those strongholds, those holdouts. And so I would encourage you that, if you have those, it's really not if you have those in your life, it's what are they? And trusting God and, engaging the body to, engage in spiritual warfare, in prayer, if you would, and in the Word to discover what those things are and what the answer is to them. And again, I'll tell you over and over this too, that the Bible is sold short. That many times in the church today, we use the Bible as an antidote and we go to our real answers to something else, to man's method or man's way of doing things, to science, to psychology, to whatever, when the Bible has the answers. And there's an answer for you right there. If you want an answer, there's one right there. For we have, there are strongholds that, but we have weapons to demolish those strongholds. So let that be an encouragement to you. And a critical ingredient in there is believing that they can be tore down. And I can't identify those things. I can't look at you and sort of miraculously tell you what your stronghold is. Now, maybe if I was around you for a while, maybe your family could tell you. Or maybe nobody knows but you. But still, those things can be broken down. When... And he kind of wraps up this section, Paul does, in verse 6. We didn't get to verse 6 last week, so we'll just go ahead and read it. And we will be ready to punish every act of disobedience once your obedience is complete. Now, he's not talking about punishing people for struggling with strongholds. That's not what he's talking about. You have the freedom to struggle. The Bible gives you the freedom to struggle. It acknowledges there's going to be a struggle. There's going to be a battle. So nobody condemns you for struggling. I certainly don't. But what he's saying here is that when these people start turning to God, he's talking to these Corinthians here, when they start turning to God, when Paul, he's been around them, he knows, he has an idea what their strongholds are. When those things are tore down, they will prove, in a sense, that they are faithful. That they are faithful because they are moving towards God. They're willing to fight the fight. They're willing to stay in the battle and continue the struggle and move towards God. And they are faithful. And he says, he's telling them, when you turn to God, when these strongholds begin to be demolished in your life, then what's going to happen is there's going to be a clear line drawn in the body. Not that Paul's going to go and necessarily draw that line, but the Holy Spirit will draw that line. It'll be obvious to you. There are those among you who are faithful and there are those among you who are not. And there's been false teachers and false apostles among you, and some of you have been following them. Now, if you don't change and become faithful to the things you've been taught and follow God and be willing to struggle with those things, if you're not faithful, it's going to be obvious. Because when the whole body starts moving and becoming faithful, those that are not faithful, it glares. It kind of stands out. And so Paul's saying, when I come to you, I'm willing to deal with it. Because there's been some false teaching that's caused division in the body. And I'm not going to stand by and let that tear up the body. So let this be your warning. He's saying, deal with it or you'll deal with me here in a little bit when I come to visit you. Paul could get bold at times. So we'll move on. Now, a lot of what's going on here is there has been some false teaching going on in the church at Corinth. And the people have been susceptible to it. They've bought into it. And so, you're going to find these last few chapters are going to be, Paul's going to be defending himself a lot. And remember the reason, this will come out again, the reason he's defending himself, because he is a true apostle. He was sent out by Jesus, and he has the truth. He has the gospel, and if they don't respond to him, if they respond to the false apostles because they're attacking Paul, and then if they push Paul out and don't listen to him, Paul's afraid for them that they're just going to just keep on going off. So he's going to defend himself a little bit. So let's go to verse 7 of chapter 10. You are looking only on the surface of things. If anyone is confident that he belongs to Christ, he should consider again that we belong to Christ just as much as he. For even if I boast somewhat freely about the authority the Lord gave us for building you up rather than tearing you down, I will not be ashamed of it. I do not want to seem to be trying to frighten you with my letters. They were accusing Paul of, Paul guy's trying to intimidate you. And so he's being a little sarcastic here. I'm not trying to frighten you with my letters. For some say his letters are weighty and forceful, but in person he is unimpressive and his speaking amounts to nothing. Such people should realize that what we are in our letters, we are when we are absent, we will be in our actions when we are present. So, many of this group have been following the false teachers. And, you know, false teachers, both the teaching of insincere teaching, if you would, teaching bad doctrine. What that does is that feeds the flesh of the person doing the teaching. And what it does to the person hearing, it feeds their flesh also. And let me explain that just a bit. Well, just give you an obvious example. I probably told you this story before. Sometimes I repeat my stories too. When I was in Trinidad, and Carlton was in Trinidad. Weren't you, Carlton? I was confused. I think you were African everywhere. When we were in Trinidad, had an opportunity to preach, and there was one of those big tent meetings, you know. And it was, you know, there were, I don't know how many people were there, a few hundred people were there. And it was just packed. And then there were, like, people standing outside, too. Just, you know, there was a pretty huge crowd. And I was teaching on Romans. And I noticed as I got in the flow of things, I could say these certain things. And the crowd, you know, they're a lively bunch, you know, down there in Trinidad. And you could hear them just kind of rise up. They would like affirm what you were saying. And I knew that if I could go over this direction, they might not affirm. But if I could go back to this, they would affirm. It sounded good to them. And while I'm standing there preaching through Romans, I found myself being tempted. I was tempted to tell them what they wanted to hear because when I told them what they wanted to hear, they would give me what I wanted. They would give me affirmation. Here's this few hundred people. In one voice, giving me, little me up there, giving me affirmation that, hey, you're doing a good job. Preach it, brother. But then, if I started telling them something they didn't want to hear, it would go silent. So which would you tend to do, you know? It would feed my flesh, my old nature, to want to get approval from them. And that would feed them. You see, because I could make them feel good. And so we had this little deal going on. I'll feed your flesh, you feed mine. We're getting along great. Everybody feels good. That's kind of the temptation of teaching, and it's the temptation also of hearing. And but I think with these particular guys, you know, there's another kind too that feed the flesh. And you remember we talked a lot about the Judaizer. These are the ones that would come from Jerusalem. And they would try to make, you remember the struggle between the Jews and the Gentiles. They'd try to make the Gentiles Jews. They'd give them all these rules to follow. You see, that's feeding the flesh too, because it makes them think by their work and by their effort they can make themselves approved by God. But then it doesn't require surrender. It doesn't require those things that we don't like. It makes them feel like, and maybe they actually end up getting controlled by guilt because of all the rules that they'll never be able to follow. But it still makes them think they possibly can make themselves acceptable to God. And it gives the people doing the teaching power over them. So, there again, you've gone the opposite direction, but you feed the flesh in both ends of the spectrum there. And so, these particular people though, they were being made to feel okay about how they were living. They were made to feel okay that they were living for themselves. They were living selfishly, and these teachers, these false teachers, this seems to be implied here, they were making them feel okay about it. So, since they've had these teachers making them feel okay about it, when Paul comes in and gives them the truth, their response to Paul is, "You're tearing us down, you're beating us up. Leave us alone, Paul." And then these false teachers are going, "Yeah, Paul is just trying to intimidate you. He's trying to burden you down." So this is kind of what was going on. But Paul is assuring them in those verses we just read that his authority and his purpose is to build them up, which requires being uncomfortable. If you're going to be built up, it requires getting uncomfortable. And every single one of us sitting here, standing here, do not want to be uncomfortable. Think about it. This applies in the everyday world too. If you're going to build yourself up physically, you're going to go in the weight room. Well, that requires getting uncomfortable. You got to do some sets until they hurt. And then it kind of tears you down. The next day, your muscles are a little achy and sore, maybe stretched or tore a few fibers. But then you notice, get you some good protein and carbs in, and your body will kind of build itself up. It took the tearing down to build up. And that's the way it seems to be in the spiritual realm too. Think about a marriage. When a couple gets married, they have this fuzzy, warm, lovey thing that lasts for a little while. But if they really want to have a depth of relationship, they have to go through a transition period. And it's uncomfortable. Is it not uncomfortable in a relationship when you have to expose your weaknesses? They have to expose theirs. And you have to accept them as they are. And you have to be willing to change. Those things are uncomfortable. So that's in relationships, in the physical world. It's the same in the spiritual world. Think about God's love. Think about God's love. Well, surely that would never hurt. Surely God's love would never hurt. It was out of God's love that Jesus ended up on the cross. It does hurt. Sometimes we have to be, God has to break us before He can fix us. But the false apostles have accused Paul of trying to intimidate them, when really Paul is speaking the hard truth to them that makes them uncomfortable. And they're saying, if he was a real leader, then he would be able to speak better. But see, this Greek culture thing had this thing. The Greeks, they really worked on this training of oratory. They had a lot of really good speakers. They could sound impressive. They could get their point across. And what they would do is charge a fee. The better the speaker, the higher the fee. Wait a minute, that sounds kind of familiar in some Christian circles. That was the way it was. Paul was not charging anything for his speaking. He was not charging anything for his investment in these Corinthians. In fact, other places were giving, and it was enabling Paul to freely do his ministry. But these guys, it's amazing how people can twist things, but they were accusing Paul because he wasn't a good leader because he wasn't charging them for his services. So they were making, and this is in chapter 11, they get to that. And that he didn't have enough charisma. That he was not the kind of leader. You see, they were applying the world standards to him rather than what we talked about earlier, the Bible standards. Let's go to verses 12 to 18. We do not dare classify or compare ourselves with some who commend themselves. You see, these guys were making their own rules up, and then they were meeting those rules, and then they were patting themselves on the back for meeting the rules that they made up, the kind of standards that they came up with. When they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they are not wise. We, however, will not boast beyond proper limits, but will confine our boasting to the field God has assigned to us, a field that reaches even to you. We are not going too far in our boasting, as would be the case if we had not come to you, for we did get as far as you with the gospel of Christ. Neither do we go beyond our limits by boasting of work done by others. Our hope is that as your faith continues to grow, as your faith grows, our area of activity among you will greatly expand so that we can preach the gospel in the regions beyond you, for we do not want to boast about the work already done in another man's territory. While defending himself against these false apostles, he's defending himself for their sake. It's concern for them. It's not concern that they would think well of Paul. He's encouraging them to persevere, to continue. They've shown some faith. He's saying, walk in that faith. Be faithful. That's the key here to all this we're going to look at today, is to be faithful. And don't be satisfied with superficial obedience. Be faithful to the end. Let your faith go deep. And we'll explain that a little more later. But to trust the Lord to the extent He wanted them to be faithful. He's watching how their faith grows. And if they continue in their faithfulness, then Paul wants them, God, to use them to spread the gospel to the next region beyond them. But first, he expects their faith to grow, for them to get to the place where they can move on and spread the gospel to the next stage beyond them. Verse 19. Is that right? Verse 18. Sorry. For it is not the one who commends himself who is approved, but the one whom the Lord commends. Again, Paul's fighting back here because these apostles, don't think that Paul didn't feel tempted here. They're tempting Paul to please himself by being a man pleaser rather than being a God pleaser. They're tempting Paul to tell the people what they want to hear rather than the truth, because it feels a lot better to be liked than to have all that other stuff he's been getting. Don't you know he cares about these people? There's legitimate, real concern and love for them. Of course he wants them to like him. That's just human nature. There's nothing wrong with that. But he becomes a man pleaser rather than a God pleaser if he just tells them what they want to hear, just like we were describing earlier. They're tempting Paul to be a man pleaser, but Paul is saying here, no, I'm going to please God and not man. Let's move on to verses 1 through 3 of chapter 11. I've never seen us cover so much ground, hey? The reason I'm covering so much ground is I want to get to these verses that are later in this chapter that just personally really impacted me this weekend. I struggled with faith this weekend. And these verses that we're going to get to really encouraged me and gave me strength to carry on in my faith. So that's where we're headed. So hang in there. Verses 1 through 3. I hope you will put up with a little of my foolishness, but you are already doing that. I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. But I am afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. Now, Paul's attitude here, he has a passion for the body. He has a passion for the purity of the body, the purity that Carlton described earlier. He has a passion that the body be single-minded in their devotion to Christ. That they be, the church is spoken of as the bride of Christ. That they be pure and holy and faithful, looking forward to the day when Christ returns. Because they are living faithfully, they can look forward to His coming. And that's where Paul, that's his job, to make sure the church is ready for the coming back of Christ. Now that's a quality you should look for in an elder. Is a leader of the church, does he have a passion for the church? Does he have a passion for the purity of the church? Is he willing to be not like, to purify the church? He will certainly have to face that, just as Paul had to face it. But that should be all of our passion. Let's go to over to Ephesians 5:25. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, to make her holy and to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. He's using this example of back and forth here between marriage, the regular union, the marriage of a man and a woman, but also using the marriage of Christ and the church. That just as a husband would like a pure wife, a single-minded wife that's devoted to him, Christ wants that same kind of purity in the church. And that comes through the word and understanding and obeying and being faithful. So, just as that was Paul's passion for a holy and pure church, that is to be all of our passion. One way we see that happen is through sacrificial community. That means staying connected. It means making a sacrifice to have friendships. Making a sacrifice to stay connected. Maybe we're naturally a loner. It means stepping out of that and being open to the community of the body of believers. Because how can the purification take place? It doesn't take place individually. It does take place individually, but it takes place altogether also. In our interaction and in our relationships and our together being in the Word and just being together. Just being together. The community. Now, Paul had a zeal for God's causes. To see God's purpose fulfilled in each one of them and for the body as a whole. Now, Paul knew the temptations that these false apostles offered. And what may have appeared to them to be a slight doctrinal error had great power to shift their pure and sincere devotion from Christ to something else. These false apostles, they may not have been doing blatant false teaching, but if they could just do some enough of a shift, then what happens is these people in Corinth end up with the wrong impression of who Jesus is. And that shifts their obedience. It shifts their faithfulness. It shifts their sincerity to Christ, their focus on Christ, to something else. Satan, what he's saying here, Satan had tempted Eve with these very same things, to shift her devotion from God to something else. You see, that's where he was going. You see, in all those little temptations and all that sly stuff he was doing back there in Genesis chapter 3, he was shifting her devotion from God to something else. He was tempting her to find her fulfillment in something other than God. That's what it boiled down to. You have such an appreciation for the beauty of things. You have such a sensitivity. You need to be fulfilled. You need to fulfill yourself. He's showing fake concern for her because God designed her to be fulfilled only by Him. And that's where Paul's going with this, that Satan had tempted Eve with fulfillment of something other than God, and that God could not inherit. The flip side of that is, God cannot be trusted to meet your needs. God cannot be trusted to fully meet your needs and bring you fulfillment. She might just have to take matters into her own hands and use some other method besides God's way to get what she desired. This is the daily battle. This is the daily battle. To get what we desire. We all have desire. To get what we desire. Where do we get what we desire? Is it from pure devotion to God? He made us. He's the only one that can meet our needs. Or do we go elsewhere to get that? Satan is always offering an exit from the way to God. Of course, he would never use religion, right? One of his favorite tools throughout history has been religion. Somehow, these guys were not told exactly what they were teaching, but they were twisting the truth just to the extent that Jesus was no longer being seen. It could have been a burden of rules to live by. I don't think that was it here. Like legalism. Or, in this case, probably a distortion in the other direction. Like this. God is so loving and kind, He would never deprive you of that. He would never deprive you of that. That warm, loving relationship you desire. That paycheck that you desire. God would never deprive you of that. Or, it's not your fault you're that way. That's the way you were born. That's the way your parents raised you. It's not your fault. Don't take the blame for that. Or, you can't be expected to submit to that. You cannot be expected. Stand up. You cannot be expected to submit. Think what's good for yourself. Those are the kinds of things that shift from your devotion to Christ to yourself. Really. That's what it's about. God wants you to be happy, doesn't He? Isn't that what God cares about? Your happiness? Let's see. 2 Corinthians 11:4. For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough. Paul goes on here to defend himself. Not for his own good, again, but for theirs. And then he gives them a stern warning. That the ones they are listening to, see before, he's just defending himself against these other false apostles. He hasn't accused them of anything. But now, he's going to. He's going to lay it out for them. He's going to tell them that these guys you're listening to are the tools of Satan. Even though they may seem sophisticated compared to Paul's simplicity, and that their message is much easier to hear through smooth speech, and also through what they're saying. Their message is easier to hear. But remember how Satan approached Eve. He was beautiful. He was intelligent. And he had her best interest at heart. Wink, wink. He appeared to have her best interest at heart. Verses 11 through 15. I'm sorry, 13 to 15. This is Paul's stern warning. For such men are false prophets, deceitful workmen, masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It is not surprising then if his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness. Their end will be what their actions deserve. We must be diligent for right doctrine. We must have the right Jesus. And we must have the right teachings of Jesus. We must have the right teachings of the church. We must have the right, we must have what the Bible says. That's where it's all written down for us. We must be committed to and fight for right doctrine. The truth. If we don't have the truth, that slight little variation will end up way off course, after a while. It's not about our ideas or our feelings. But it's about the truth. But that's not all. There's something else to add to the truth. And that next section speaks of this. God's ways are not like man's ways. He does not seek our immediate comfort. Now we do. We do. We seek our immediate comfort. That's what was one thing we're after. He does not seek our immediate comfort, and He always requires faith. Do not misunderstand me. It is not that God does not want us to pursue joy. It's not. We've talked about that before. It's not that you are not pursuing, that you're pursuing joy too much. It's that you're not pursuing it enough. That's the problem. Because where are you looking for your joy? Here's a quote from Randy Alcorn here from the book, Desiring God. God remains gloriously all-satisfying. The human heart remains a ceaseless factory of desires. Sin remains powerfully and suicidally appealing. The battle remains. Where will we drink? Where will we feast? Where will we find our joy and our contentment? That is the question. What is the first step in being used by God and enjoying Him to the fullest? Those are two things Paul's talking about. He's talking about being used in the kingdom, about being used for God's purposes in this world. And what's the first step in enjoying Him to the fullest, which is the most complete joy possible? To be fulfilled in Christ is the most complete joy possible. I've been fulfilled in other things, in learning new stuff, in pursuit of adventure, in athletics. There's pleasure in those things. But when I'm complete in God, there's a peace, and you know this, there is a peace that is deeper, more substantial, more unwavering than any other peace or joy that is available. So Paul gives us some answers here. And Emily already told me what my answer is. She reminded me that that's something I say every week. And I mentioned that earlier today. And I said, she said, Pastor Steve, you say the same thing every week. And I said, you're right. I do. And myself, I said, that's a good observation. It really is. That was a good observation. I'm glad she saw that. Because it is the key. It opens the door. Faith. It opens the door to this kind of joy, this kind of peace, this kind of usefulness of God. So, I think I'm going to keep saying it. I think I'll keep saying it until I learn it. What is it that I like about Daniel? What is it that I like about Esther? They believed God. They believed Him. And they got the benefit of it too. Intimacy with God. Usefulness for His purposes. So, Paul goes on to defend himself some more. And he talks about some of the ways he learned this faith that he has. This faith that opened doors for him. He talks about his many and severe trials and temptations. Let's go to verses 23 through 29 of chapter 11. Are they the servants of Christ? I am out of my mind to talk like this. I am more. I have worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, and been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I went a night and a day in the open sea. I have been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false brothers. I have labored and toiled, and I have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have been often gone without food. I've been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for the churches. Who is weak and I do not feel weak? Who is led into sin and I do not inwardly burn? And then he gets to the point in verse 30, the point all this was taking him to. If I boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. And he goes on in the first part of chapter 12. You can turn over there. In the first part of chapter 12, he goes on to tell of visions and revelations that he's never told anyone about. Because he didn't want to mislead them into thinking it was his super spirituality or ability that made him useful in God's work, when it was entirely something else. It was not his super spirituality or his ability or his education that made him useful for anything else. Now, some of the details of those verses we'll get into next week. There's some things there that raise questions. But the point we're getting to now is something else. Paul wants them to know that it's not his ability or his strength, even his apostleship, that makes him useful to God or brings him this kind of faith. Paul came to the realization of his weakness. Now, we all at some point, at some time, come to realization of our weakness. When I come to the realization of my weakness, let me tell you what my tendency is. Throw a party. A pity party. When I see my weakness, my tendency, and maybe yours too, is to feel sorry for myself. I don't have the ability. I don't have the education. I can't speak like that guy. How am I ever going to do what you're calling me to do here, God? I can't do those things. That's not what he's talking about when he says to see your weakness. Now, I may go through that phase. Let's read these verses, 7-9. To keep me from becoming conceited because of these surpassingly great revelations, there was given me a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me. But he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. He wants you to be useful in the kingdom. And he wants you to have joy in the sincere and pure devotion to him as a bride would to the bridegroom. Both of these come not through seeking comfort. Both of these do not come through seeking our comfort, but in deeply seeing our weakness. I mean, having a deep, real vision of our weakness to really see how weak we are and how much we cannot do. And then placing our faith fully in him. How did Paul come to see his weaknesses? It was through difficulties and trial and failing. He came to see his weakness. Let's go to a few other verses here. Psalm 66, 8-12. Praise our God, O peoples, let the sound of his praise be heard. He has preserved our lives and kept our feet from slipping. For you, O God, tested us. You refined us like silver. You brought us into prison and laid burdens on our backs. You let men ride over our heads. We went through the fire and water, but you brought us to a place of abundance. And 1 Peter 1:6-9. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. These have come so that your faith of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may be proved genuine and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. Though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy, for you are receiving the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Faith cannot be tested, and it cannot be built without some difficulties and some times of not knowing where to turn. Some times of not seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. When you want an answer so bad, but it's not coming. When you want to see something that you can latch on to, and it's not happening. When you want a relationship that you can bank on, and you don't have it. When it's dark, that's when faith is built, and that's what pleases God. Because he doesn't want you latching on to anything else. He didn't want you counting on anything else. He wants you to count on him. He wants your pure devotion. And that comes out of faith. Hebrews 11:6. And I think it's there in your outline. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to Him must believe that He exists and that He rewards those who earnestly seek Him. A part of having faith is not having faith. A part of learning to trust God is not trusting Him. But you have to not get frantic. You have to not get desperate. You have to turn to God, pursue Him, and believe Him before the light comes. The light's coming. But to please Him, you got to turn to Him and believe Him. Because the light will come, and He'll show you who He is. He'll reveal Himself to you. But faith is built in the darkness. And that is the time to trust God, to please Him. It brings great joy to Him for you to trust Him in the difficult times. And that's when your faith is built. So, that is the question to us, to you individually, for us as a body. Will we be faithful? Are we willing to persevere? Will we remain faithful to the end, no matter what we see, no matter the results we see, no matter what happens around us?